Oh, hi everyone, lovely to be back.
Hello.
I'm sorry I missed last month, but I was able to listen online to Kerry's talk, and she introduced the theme of paradoxes, of course, so it's great that Robin records these talks. So I'd like to begin by just refreshing our mind about what paradox is. So, paradox. A statement or concept that contains conflicting ideas, from the Greek paradoxon, contrary to expectations, existing belief or perceived opinion. So an example of this, as this little picture is trying to illustrate, is God uses the simple things to confound the wise. So, for example, worldly thinking expects educated people to be the leaders and teachers, and the paradox is that God often doesn't. He works in ways contrary to human expectations. As this caption says, God doesn't call the qualified, he qualifies the called.
That's clever.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
And all through the Bible, God gives us a new way of thinking which is opposed to our natural expectations. He loves paradoxes, and when you start looking, they're everywhere in the Bible. So these, I'll just run through the examples that I used on that program that everyone got at the start. So it's a human expectation that the greatest people have servants, but Jesus said the opposite, that the greatest among you will be your servant. The next one was, it's a human expectation that the leaders of people have the greatest insight and perception to lead wisely. So this is a picture of a rabbi and some modern day religious leaders. But Jesus said, the blind will see and those who see will be blind. Meaning the so-called leaders often just don't understand what God really wants. And the third picture on the program was the wedding banquet. Go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet. So I love this picture. You can see the invited, originally invited guests looking on in their suits and ties and well-to-do clothes. And if you have a close look at the picture, you'll see all the street people, the riffraff, or, you know, what we think are, you know, they might be really poor, homeless. But it's the last days, as Duncan always says in this parable, the urgency to bring people to God gets more and more intense. So go to the highways, byways, drag people off the streets. So he wants everyone, and the people who expect to be there may very well miss out. That's sort of the paradox of worldly thinking. And of course, the ones who were originally invited, the Jews, like, that they had the invitation first, and they sort of got it completely wrong. Okay, so all those explanations were pretty self-explanatory. But there's lots of paradoxes where different parts of the Bible seem to actually be in paradox. So they were obvious because it was contained within the same passage. But, like, for instance, my favourite one, when I quote the devil tempting Jesus, and he said, throw yourself off the temple, and Jesus replied, well, I can't do that because we're told not to tempt God. So he was like comparing passages from completely different parts of the Bible that were in paradox, and putting them together and coming up with the right thing to do. So just because paradoxes are separated in different parts of the Bible, you've still got to consider the whole as what is right. So So, and that brings me to my topic, the paradox of law and grace, or if you like, the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I really struggled with this for a long time. A lot of people have. In the first century, the Gnostics said the God of the Old Testament was so completely different to the God of the New Testament that it wasn't even the same God. The God of the Old Testament was an evil God, and the God of the New Testament was another God who was good. So this is like an age-old problem, the conflict between the God of the Old and the God of the New Testament. So let's look at the Beatitudes and compare them with the Law of Moses. According to Wiki, the Beatitudes are 8 blessings recounted in the Sermon on the Mount in the Gospel of Matthew. So that's what the Beatitudes are defined as. And I've asked Julie to read them out for us, thanks.
Okay, thanks. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the poor, are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Thanks, Julie. I really love the Sermon on the Mount. To me, that sort of encapsulates what the Gospel is all about, chapter 5 and chapter 6 of Matthew. So Wiki goes on to say that these teachings on the Sermon on the Mount actually present a new set of Christian ideals. What do you think of that? Do you think they do?
No, they shouldn't. It should be the same all the way. Gotta find it in the Old Testament.
It might have been to them at the time,
presented in a different way.
Yeah. Yes, because it had been perverted.
Oh, well.
Interpreted.
Yes. All on the right track, I think. Okay. Now, I've asked Kim to read something out of the law.
You must destroy them totally, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. Deuteronomy 7:2-3.
Okay, so we've got pretty conflicting ideas here. When you put those verses together, that's clearly a paradox. So our job is to explain it. Okay, so I want to make a point here. The God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament seem different on the surface, but they can't be because, as you've said, Jesus revealed God. He didn't change God. John 1:18, no man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son has declared him. So God was always the same. Jesus showed his character. He came as light to a world in darkness where the rulers were not portraying God as they should have been. And we know the sun had long set on the prophets. And it had been a long time since the Davids and the Deborahs and the Zacharias who, you know, were teaching people the right thing about God. So Jesus burst onto the scene with wonderful teachings like those on the Sermon on the Mount. But were they really new teachings? It's interesting that Jesus actually endorses the law within the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew 5 itself, he says, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." So even whilst giving these seemingly new words about mercy, he's endorsing the law. So they were all under the law. Everything he was saying was while the law was still operational. It's interesting that the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, the law of Moses says this, but what do you say? And so what was going on here is the Jews themselves interpreted the law. That's why they had volumes and volumes of Talmuds and Mishnahs. And they were used to their rabbis interpreting the law. And Jesus was a recognized rabbi. You had to have a band of male disciples to be a rabbi. And so he met all their qualifications. So he was treated as a rabbi, someone who's allowed to interpret the law. The Jews at certain times even allowed female sages to interpret the law. So next I'd like to talk about a really interesting one. Has anyone heard of Beriah?
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. This is an interesting picture too. Her father was a rabbi who lived during the Bar Kokhba rebellion of 135 AD. So we tend to think of AD 70 being when the Jews were wiped out from Judea, but that it actually wasn't. That's just when the temple was destroyed. They kept living and worshipping there. The final really big wipeout was the Bar Kokhba rebellion. And Bar Kokhba means son of a star. So his original name was Son of Simon, I think. And when Jesus warned, beware of false messiahs, well, this is like definitely one of the guys. So he changed his name to Son of a Star, meaning referring, of course, to numbers. You know, a star will come out of Jacob as the Messiah they were looking for. So this coin here, see the little coin up the top there? That's a picture of the temple with the star above it minted in for Bar Kokhba. And he led this huge rebellion against Rome, and there were 580,000 Jews killed at that time. And so Jerusalem, AD 70, that wiped out the city, but this one wiped out many towns, many people. Like the curse in Leviticus said, if you disobey me, I'll wipe you out in your cities, I'll wipe you out in your towns, I'll scatter you. So this is when they got wiped out in the other towns and got finally scattered. And Hadrian, of course, was the Roman emperor at the time, and there's that very famous statue of Hadrian with a Jew under his foot. And of course, we've got the prophecies that the fourth and dreadful beast will trample underfoot, and that just really depicts it. So he's the one that scattered them and changed the name from Judea to Palestinian. As a real insult, like it's, you know, the Philistines, no Jews, and they were banned from the temple area, and it was a really big wipeout. So her father, Beriah's father, was a rabbi who opposed Rome, and he kept teaching the Torah, and he was murdered, but he educated his daughter, and she was such an academic, said she exceeded her brothers, she exceeded all the other rabbis, and there's so much, there's, you know, a bit written about her in the Talmud, which in itself, she would have had to be exceptional to outwit the others in her teaching to get in the Talmud. So, but she was recognized as a sage or teacher herself. So this is one of the things she said. So this is her husband was Rabbi Meir. He prayed that an annoying neighbour would die.
As you do.
This is in one of the Talmud or Mishnah, I forgot to put the quote. Appalled by this, she responded to him by explaining that the verse, let the sinners be consumed from the earth and the wicked shall be no more, which is Psalm 104:35, actually states, let sin be consumed from the earth. adding that the wicked shall be no more because they have repented.
Oh,
that's a huge difference.
That is a huge difference.
Yeah, now, this is a slight difference.
So this is a woman, she's actually questioning the translation, which I think we're allowed to do. Some of the translations have really led us astray on just little words that make a huge difference. And
not to mention the punctuation, which didn't exist in the
original. No punctuation. No quotation marks. No quotation marks to show that this is one group of people saying this and this is another. And it's all mixed in together. And she was closer to the time. So I think she was, you know, she probably had the right translation because she was such an academic. Okay, so this is showing that it was recognised amongst the Jews you're allowed to translate the law. Okay. So back to the Beatitudes. Were they a new teaching or how the law should always have been being interpreted? So Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, and he's quoting the law here, an eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. So the law he's quoting is Exodus 21. If there's any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. So Jesus is actually quoting the law and reinterpreting it. I mean, there's no... I mean, we would read the law and say, oh, this is what God says, it's all inspired, we have to take it all at face value, all literally. But Jesus quoted that very law and said no. He put a new construction on it. Okay. And of course there's the time that one of the Pharisees who was an expert in the law came to Jesus and said, which is the greatest commandment? And again, this is asking his opinion as a rabbi to interpret the law. And Jesus said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commands hang all the law and prophets. So Jesus was actually saying there's a hierarchy of commandments. And the most important are that, you know, loving God and loving your neighbour. On these hang all the others. So I love this illustration of the law inside the ark and with the mercy seat above the law. I mean, that's sort of a visual image that mercy is above law. And of course Jesus expected Nicodemus to interpret the law as he did. By being born again, not being born a Jew. He said, you must be born again. I mean, where is that in the law of Moses? Are you a teacher of Israel and yet you don't understand these things? He failed to look below the surface and interpret from the law that Jewish lineage didn't matter. It never mattered. So I threw in this picture. This is a modern-day Jew that is still thinking he's superior, who said, the sole purpose of non-Jews is to serve Jews. The Goyim were born only to serve us. They have no place in the world, and I didn't get the end of the quote. But so there's this superior attitude, and sadly it's a bit of a human trait. Like lots of churches, cultures think they're superior. It's something we all think we're right, and, you know... Just having come from Italy and having a few nasty experiences with the Italians who think this is their country, you have to do things their way, we're right. It's, you can see it everywhere.
Well, we're glad you've explained to us our purpose. We shall now go out and serve the Jewish community.
Oh, okay.
Does everybody know what the Goyim is?
Goyim. Yeah, Gentiles, foreigners, Gentiles, non-Jews.
That's right.
It doesn't matter what you are. You're not Jewish. It doesn't count.
But you can see why, you know, they would actually stir up a bit of aggression towards themselves with that.
Just a bit. It doesn't inspire likeability, does it?
It does not, no.
But you know, Christadelphians have said that for years. We've got the gospel.
Yeah, we alone have the truth.
Yes, God.
Okay. Jesus, the one who really was superior, revealed God. Actually, this is sort of repeating my other one.
I love that phone.
Yeah. So Jesus was the one who had it all together and, you know, portrayed God properly. So in the next few slides, I'm going to compare the words and actions of Jesus with the law. So, first of all, we'll look at this one. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown merciful. And the law said, and when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, you will smite them and utterly destroy them. You will make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. So this paradox of showing mercy. And yet, when Israel went into the promised land, before they'd even taken it, they broke all these laws with approval. Let's look what happened. So, covenant to Rahab. They were told in Deuteronomy, make no covenant. But it says in Joshua 2, swear to me by the Lord, which is the covenant, that you will show kindness or have mercy to my family because I have shown kindness to you. And they were also told not to marry them. So what happens, of course, Rahab marries into the whole system as well. Everyone who, that whole strict-sounding law in Deuteronomy was broken as soon as they go into the promised land. But it wasn't wrong. So on the surface, Deuteronomy 7 seems to say one thing, but in reality, what happens, mercy is shown and it's okay. So look at the next one. The rules for sacrifices. So we've got the whole first seven chapters of Leviticus, which describe the various offerings and how they should be carried out, the peace offering, burnt offering, sin offering. It doesn't say they weren't required. It says, you know, you've got to do all these offerings. So what did Jesus say? In Hebrews it says, when Jesus came into the world, he said, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you prepared for me. With burnt offerings and sin offerings, you were not pleased. So, okay, what about the seven chapters that say he actually wanted all offerings? And, of course, in the prophets, Hosea said, for I desired mercy and not sacrifice and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings.
That one about Jesus, isn't he also quoting David from the Psalms? Samuel?
Yeah. David said that as well. And yeah, so David was one of the ones who got it. Yeah. Now let's look at another example, death for adultery. The law said, if a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbour, both the adulterer and the adulteress are to be put to death. There's no ifs and buts here in the law. There's no out clauses, you can show mercy. It never says that. What happens is the law gets interpreted and they just do show mercy. So Jesus said when they brought the woman caught in adultery, the Pharisees said to him, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. Notice even the Pharisees quote the law of Moses and say, the law says to stone her. There's
not
no...
them.
It said
not
both
them.
Of them.
Yeah, not them.
Yeah, that's the adulterer and adulteress.
That's true.
So they're reinterpreted only to stone the woman.
Darling, he ran too fast and left only his loincloth behind.
Yeah. But of course we all know the answer that Jesus showed mercy. Neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more. And then we've got the miscellaneous examples of David's sin with Bathsheba committing adultery, and he appealed to God for mercy because he knew God was merciful. said, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgression. And of course there's a classic case of Joseph married or engaged to Mary, which was as good as marriage. Under the law, as far as he was concerned, she had committed adultery for all he knew, and he resolved to put her away quietly and was commended for that as a just man. So that was, he was commended for breaking the law. So Jesus and these people with insight know that you can break the law. So another one is the rebellious son to be stoned. If someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother, all the men of his town are to stone him to death. Again, there's no ifs and buts. This is just what you do under the law.
And I should see a lot of teenagers gone in our group.
And the most rebellious son that springs to mind is Absalom. More and more people are joining Absalom and supporting his plot. When you hear the sound of trumpets, you must shout, Absalom now rules as king in Hebron. He rebelled against his own father to become king. But of course, David was merciful. He loved Absalom. He mourned his death, so he didn't, you know, have his own son stoned. And of course, Psalm 103 says, he does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. And I think this is my last one in this little series, destruction and rejection of foreigners. The law said, you'll utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord has, your God has commanded. And no Ammonite or Moabite or any descendant may enter the assembly of the Lord even to the tenth generation.
So Ruth was a Moabite.
Yes, Ruth is. Oh, yeah. Hang on. I clicked the wrong way. Okay, Jesus said when he went to the temple, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. And I think we tend to think of that quote as in the King James. Oh, you'll have all your everyone there then.
Where is this? Right. Where's that in the scripture that you just
said? It's Isaiah somewhere.
He's quoting Isaiah.
Yeah, in Mark 11, right. Jesus quoted Isaiah.
Right.
And said, my house will be called a house of prayer. But Jesus applied Isaiah to his time and condemned them for not having it at that time a house of prayer for all nations. So it's not a future concept, it's a concept that should have always existed. And as thou said, Ruth the Moabitess, the ancestor of Jesus, was a Moabitess, and well within that 10th generation. She was about the 3rd generation. So she shouldn't have been there if you follow the law. And of course Rahab was a Canaanite, Uriah was a Hittite but a godly man. And God calls the Israelites themselves foreigners. He says, this is what the sovereign Lord says to Jerusalem. Your ancestry and birth were in the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. So who are the Jews to point the finger at foreigners? And you know, the Jews, they're all intermarried. Look at Moses' wife from Midian, and so Joseph's wife was an Egyptian, you know. They were built on intermarriage with foreigners.
But that doesn't prevent the consequences of all that.
What do you mean?
Well, God doesn't take away the consequences. If you marry a Hittite, then there will be some consequences, but we need to deal with those.
But if the Hittites change, become the
consequences are there of David marrying these women, but they dealt with the consequences.
But both those women, you know, reached out to be part of the
But why did they reach out? They might have taught them. And that's a lesson that they
I think if you've got a hitchhiker's character, it's all to do with character.
Yeah. And converted. Yeah. If you convert before they can wipe you out, then you've got to put in the door. You're not to marry them if they don't convert. Then you wipe them out. So Rahab was like that, Mariah, very clever.
Well, she knew, she said that, you know, that's your God. She knew that it was God.
So is that what they were interpreting when they were told, when they were told to put away their foreign wives?
Yeah, that was the Jews' interpretation. They were all also saying, if you can't find your Jewish certificate of what tribe you're from, you've got no inheritance in Israel.
Yeah.
So that's how the Old Testament ends. They're all in, and then you come to the New Testament, it says, God can raise children to Abraham from these stones. It shouldn't have mattered.
Look, they're so literal, and
this really worries me. If it's true, if we've got the right interpretation of the Old Testament, and all those laws written are as God gave them, they are so absolute about how you're supposed to behave. And then we get to the New Testament, it goes to...
Well, we
how were those Jews expected to know any other way?
Well, the people like David did. They interpreted.
Yeah.
They knew. Actually,
odd people, just the odd person.
Actually, we're missing out. We've come like thousands of years after the law. To them at the time, I think they understood they could interpret.
So you're basing that on just I think, or you're basing
that? These quotes I've given. Yeah. This is what David did, so he knew that. It's showing that they had a better understanding of how to deal with the law than we do.
And yet David did a whole lot of other dreadful things, you know, so...
And he knew those were dreadful too.
Don't
forget that David studied the law night and day.
Yes.
Whereas the ordinary person, they didn't.
They only could, and they were told they couldn't even read probably most of them.
Well, this is another thing, you see, it was mostly oral, so God said he wants his law within our hearts, and I think that's what they had. They had God's, you know, the good ones, they had his law in their hearts.
But the way it's there in the Bible is hard, and we
should... It was hard for us.
No, I don't think so.
The trouble is,
tell me why.
I think Robin's saying they had a... They had it in their hearts, but they had a visual representation to you know, in the tabernacle and the offerings.
Yeah, true.
That was all there to teach them really love.
We've forgotten what they were and where they came from. They came from Egypt, from a completely different religious system.
Appalling.
Plus, if somebody called your mother a pig, that you were obliged by family honour to go and wipe out the entire tribe. So we're reading it out of context. And the context was hard.
The world
they lived in was incredibly hard. And when you look at that, you think, my goodness, the law looks lenient. It looks fair. It says, okay, your impulse is to take revenge. You can only take for injury. You cannot take any more from that person. You can't start a vendetta. And once you've taken... then it's over. So we've forgotten to read in context. And so when Christ delivers the Beatitudes, who's the oppressor? Rome. And he says, don't resist an evil person, because he knew that the Jews would be wiped out by resisting Rome, and they were under Rome because they resisted God. Does that make sense?
Sort of.
But there are difficult things, like it's not all just... So this is like...
There must have been, because Naomi brought Ruth, and she came all the way into the family.
Yeah, but you're just picking out odd people.
Yeah.
You're not talking about the
thousands. Robin's talking about the
people. The odd people are examples. Yeah. But she didn't say, your God is my God. She wanted to go there.
Plus, Ruth had gone to Moab first with her husband. They shot through from Israel to Moab, so they were in the wrong to start with.
So she changed along the way because of the
mother. Yeah.
But there are so many paradoxes still that we haven't. Another one is all these difficult imprecatory psalms which call for vengeance. That like they're really difficult.
They're all smashing psalms.
So this is a classic. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundation. Daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who destroys your property and dashes them against the rocks. So how is this showing this mercy that we're just reading about in the Beatitudes of turning the other cheek? Okay, so to start with, don't forget that this is what Babylon did to Jews. They smashed their children on the rocks. But I think this is like daughter of Babylon. This is symbolic language. Babylon is the symbol of the kingdoms of men. So if you're part of that kingdom, it is doomed to destruction. Like this image here, it's ultimate, with a head of gold that was Babylon, it's ultimately going to be destroyed.
So you said it's a prophecy.
Yeah. I think ones like this are. Because I think happy is the one who destroys your children. It's not talking in a literal sense, but the progeny of Babylon will be destroyed. Like the thinking of Babylon.
Yeah, the progeny of sin.
The kingdoms of men. So I think there's a bigger picture here for a lot of these imprecatory psalms that even David said. Because remember David, he said, you know, wipe out the enemies, your enemies. And what did he do when Saul died? He mourned him. He mourned for Saul and Jonathan, and he said, oh, Saul, Saul, God's chosen.
But then didn't he go around and kill all of Saul's children?
Oh, well, he recommended that Solomon
did.
Yeah, well, I don't have all the answers.
Well, it doesn't mean to say it was right, though. But also this psalm is actually giving God the thing. Like, God says, vengeance is mine.
Yeah.
And this psalm is saying, remember, Lord, what they did and take me. You know, and that's...
David is praying for the progeny of Babylon, it will ultimately be destroyed and sin will be no more. I think you can...
Oh, that's okay. I think that's a good point. That's a literal.
Yeah, like we come along now, 3,000 years later, and try and interpret it.
I think we still do the same thing.
We still forget what it's
coming from. And also, Robin, don't you think that the whole culture, the way they spoke, all the Middle Eastern people express themselves a whole different way to us. Yes. We're very cold and practical and A and B and C. So that whereas a lot of these things, they might be able to know how to interpret it because they're Middle Eastern people.
But people love to... quote the example of Agag and the Amalekites as the classic of God being cold-hearted and demanding he was cut into pieces, and that's what Saul did. But you've got to remember that just like, remember Nineveh, God let them go on for another 400 years till he wiped them out, till their iniquity was full. And this is what happened with Agag. When the Jews went into the promised land, they heckled them coming into the land, Agag and, well, not Agag, but the Amalekites. And that must have continued until this snap got, this was after 500 years, God gave the word, it's time to wipe. These people haven't improved in 500 years. They're still a perpetual enemy. And remember, they were descended from Esau, who sold his birthright. He could have been, you know, one of God's people. He chose not to be. And so God, he does judge the wicked. There does come a time when God says enough. And so to wrap it up, I believe God deliberately puts paradoxes throughout the Bible. On the one hand, he says exclude the Moabites, and on the other hand, he lets people like Ruth come in. And what we have to do is know how to interpret the things. Otherwise, we'll be like the man in the parable, Jesus' master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, so I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. So this man, he thought he understood what God wanted, but he was, you know, had the wrong impression and giving, you know, we can have the wrong impression and pass that on to others. So my concluding thought, to many, the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament seem like different gods. This is a paradox between the Old Testament and the New, but they can't be different gods because Jesus came and revealed God. He didn't come and change God. He showed the way, he changed the way people saw him. He showed us how the law should have been interpreted. And I've just got a little, some present day events to, because I'm quite excited about them. So, but I thought if you wanted to talk about this first, I've only got two slides. So, any comments then?
Oh, before you go on.
Yeah.
Wow.
I would say we're pretty much like the Old Testament. We're all very pure and we've got the truth and we don't sin much. We grade our sins, actually. I don't think we do, but some people say, well, that's not too bad, but this is really dreadful, abominable behaviour, which you might guess going on at the moment is the word that people are using. It's abominable sin. So that's much worse than any of ours.
That's not
here at the top. And then we say to someone who comes to our meeting, or we could say someone who comes to our meeting and they have quite a lot of really hard sins, and we say, go and sin not, and then come back and talk to us. I think we're a bit hard. We don't want to have these people who are around who might be needing the gospel. It's too hard for us, so we say, go and sin no more, and then come back and see us.
I think we've got to remember we're really in the last days, and the parable of just trying urgently, bring everyone in. It's not long left.
I think we also forget that law is just a written or verbal contract. It actually doesn't do anything on its own. Someone has to bring a charge. Judges have to be appointed. Evidence has to be weighed up. If you choose not to bring a charge out of mercy, the law does not come into play, does it? We forget that we read all these hard statements, but we don't say to ourselves, so when would someone apply it? And when would someone go along to a leader and say, my teenagers are out of control, I want to stop them.
I think it comes down to love. Love. What are you going to do? Are you going to take your teenage son and show him up the gate and stone him? Or do you love him?
Some people have too much compassion. And sisters are pretty, they've got too much compassion, and that's why they shouldn't be making decisions in the meeting. Because they have too much love.
Oh, right.
And that's bad for us, because we need to keep pure.
But see, sometimes you need laws to keep people on straight and narrow. But those laws, if you were a child in those days, and you thought, if I go against my father, I'm going to be stoned, well, I won't go against my father. What Rob was saying about the Beatitudes and everything else, what Jesus was saying isn't anything new in Psalms. Psalm 37, 11, 12, but the meek shall inherit the earth. So Jesus is only reiterating what God's already said many times. And what I said to you before, I'm thinking about this morning, and if you live by the letter of the law, you're basically living by fear, in a sense, or works. You know, because the Pharisees turned it into works. I'll do this and I'll live by that letter, and then I'll be righteous because, and I'll have salvation because I've lived by works. If you live to the spirit of the law, and you can see that in those laws are good laws that protect women about divorce and about, you know, other things, then you're living with the grace. This is where the law and grace comes into effect. You're having salvation by grace and faith and love. And so the spirit of the law has always been, and that's a paradox, the spirit of the law, it still should be living by the law, but not the letter of the law.
Well, and laws are there to stop anarchy, and we forget that in that culture, Women and children were the possessions of the man. Therefore, as his possession, he could have killed his children, whether they were right or wrong, nice or nasty. And what the law says is no. You have to, if you want to kill your children, you have to prove that they are a problem. And people have to make a judgment. You can't just act on your own sense of ownership. That's what we've forgotten about this, that it was trying to put order on a rabble. Do you reckon?
But I think it really does say that it's, you realise it's a very personal thing.
Yes.
You can't remain hard-hearted. Yourself, you can't be stiff-necked, because if we have those wrong characteristics, then the whole group becomes like that. So it's up to everyone. You can't really step back and say, well, I don't think about those things. That's really abrogating yourself of the responsibility we all have to think things through. And we should be thinking, if it seems really against what Jesus says, well, we've got to rethink. Or you know, it's just our action, or our perception might be incorrect.
Yeah. And you have to treat the people who come with love and compassion.
That's right.
I don't think you're going to have too much compassion or love. That seems ridiculous to me.
Well, I think it probably is.
It just depends, though. Like, if people have problems, sometimes the worst thing to do is indulge it rather than say you need to get help. Do you know what I mean? It morphs, and you're not helping the person because they reinforce a habit until it's unbreakable.
Yes.
And that's what we need to say to ourselves. Well, I'm the rebellious son or daughter. God has every right to stone me and cut me off. What do I need to do?
But he doesn't do it.
Okay. Oh, well, I might just quickly move on.
Yes. Now, did you draw this topic?
No, I did not. No. This is there's so many interesting news articles that are just leaping out of the pages of Daniel and Revelation at the moment.
Yes.
So this, Daniel 7, we all know the prophecy. There before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them. And three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. So this little horn, it's the image of the beast of Revelation 13. It's the same thing it's talking about. It's the entity that comes against Israel in the last days. So I believe that the horns are the Arabs around Israel, and Iran is now the leash on this dog, as it's depicted in this news article. Iran, already heavily involved in Syria, is also deeply involved in Lebanon and Iraq. As a result, Israel is justifiably feeling surrounded.
Yeah.
Israel's very afraid of, because of this whole vacuum of power from ISIS. ISIS had the whole Euphrates Valley. And that's the Syria, this whole mess, it's given Iran a chance to get a foothold in all these areas, to get like a land bridge. It's shipping its weapons where it couldn't do before. It's making peace with Hamas, who are a common enemy of Israel.
It's a land bridge effect now.
That's right. And I believe it really seems like Iran is the little horn emerging that has control amongst three other horns, which are Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. And of course, Revelation 16, it talks about the Euphrates drying up, which I believe the time is up. And you look at, well, who's had power on the Euphrates? And it's been ISIS. And their power is drying up to the way of the kings of the East. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the Old Testament, the kings of the East, and you always look to the Old Testament to interpret Revelation. So when you say for the kings of the East, the mind goes back to what happened there the first time when Babylon fell, the Euphrates dried up, and the Medes and Persians captured it, and that is Iran now, the Medes and Persians, that area. So for the kings of the east to cross the Euphrates, that means Iran is like, it's like got power across the Euphrates now. And another news article said, Iran is stronger and bolder than ever and building weapon factories in Lebanon and Syria. By reconciling with Hamas, it has the capacity to create what might be a three-front war against the Jewish state whenever it chooses to heat up the conflict. And this is a really good map showing the same thing. And it's called The Head of the Snake. The article was entitled that. It's talking about Iran. So it's supplying all these places with weapons, rockets, money, and these places, they all have the common enemy of Israel. So we've got, you know, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and like it's just there next to Israel. And of course, I'll just read you what it says in Revelation 16, which I was quoting before. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Then I saw three impure spirits that looked like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, which Revelation 12 identifies as the spirit of deception, Satan, from the beginning. So a deceptive spirit out of the mouth of the beast, which the beast has various stages, and we're up to the ten horns and the little horn. And out of the mouth of the false prophet, which is radical Islam. And they are demonic spirits that perform great signs, and they go out to the kings. Oh, this is a bad translation. It should say, to the kings of the earth and the whole world, meaning the local area and beyond, and gather them for the battle on the great day of God. And this is exactly what's happened in this area of Syria. Right? We've got all the armies of the world gathered there, sitting, and this is what they're waiting for. They don't know, but it's actually going to be the Battle of Armageddon. And I've actually just written another book, and this one's Revelation, The Time is at Hand. And I've got a lend copy if anyone wants to borrow and pass it on. Or I've got just one left that someone can buy or borrow or whatever. Or you can just read it all online. I've got it's on my blog on my link if you want to read it online. So that's it.